Prokopyev worked his way along the wall's base, the wall almost seeming to radiate tension. Senior Sergeant Pyotr Yaroslav was just to Prokopyev's rear as he glanced back, the men following Yaroslav in single file. Prokopyev's fists were balled tightly to his rifle at the pistol grip and small of the stock. This, the newest version of the service rifle, issued just prior to the Hero Marshal's assault on the underground city. Like its predecessor, it was modularly constructed, firing a caseless round, as did all firearms of modern design. But it was constructed entirely of stainless steel, high-strength aluminum alloys, and polymers with 40-round disposable magazines. The Vasanov 26 was state-of-the-art. He felt its abilities would be needed soon. Beyond the wall lay a vast field, at its furthest extent perhaps a mile, the gray base of a mountain, and visible in the mountain, the entryway to the second Chinese city. Prokopyev wanted battle, not reconnaissance. But duty was duty. He wanted to crush any and all Chinese for their betrayal of communism, their support of what was then the United States during the critical period following the exchange of missiles and bombs. But the Comrade Colonel Antonovich wanted their trust first, and then their destruction could come. Prokopyev would wait, would follow orders, at least for now. He kept moving. Long ago, John Rourke had climbed to the mountaintop to raise the Stars and Stripes. He'd shot it out with Rozhdestvenskaya, and he dove into the tunnel as the flames had closed around him. He had used the tunnel again to see if there was a world at all remaining after he had first awakened from the sleep. He stood atop the mountain now. Lost in thought was the expression which came to mind, trite but accurate. Paul Rubinstein stood beside him.
I was never up here. Now you could see. In good weather, you could...
A lot of Georgia into the Carolinas. When I built the retreat, I never wanted it to be used for this. But I saw it coming, Paul. God help me, I saw it coming.
Mene, mene, tekal uparsin.
The handwriting on the wall.
Rourke started for the side along which the enemy climbers were coming. John Rourke crouched beside the rocks near which he had stood bracing Rozhdestvenskaya 5 centuries before. But rather than a helicopter gunship, he waited for 8 men. And this time, he was not alone. Paul Rubinstein was hidden 12 yards off, prone behind ice-slicked boulders which had weathered millennia here. And fire did not well up to consume the skies now. Snow and sleet driven on powerful winds swirling about the mountaintop instead. The Python in the full-flap holster at his right hip was packed with snow between the rear of the trigger guard and the grip front strap, the flap not providing enough protection. He had left the Scoremasters in the backpack, the pack hidden away closer to the far edge of the mountaintop. But it would not come to guns immediately, perhaps, because if the attackers had kept to their climbing formation, only 2 of them at a time would reach the summit, and to open fire would simply have alerted the others to trouble. It would be easy enough to shoot down at them on the rocks, but there were a sufficient number of wide ledges along the face that the objects attached to their packs, rockets apparently, might be employed. And Rourke had no idea of their capabilities. Had the Steyr Mannlicher SSG been with him, rather than left behind with Sarah at the first Chinese city, the proposition would have been little different. He would have been pushing the yardage to attempt, from hiding, to have picked the climbers off the mountainside, rather than climb up to intercept them. And the 308s the SSG fired would have behaved erratically in the high winds. Instead, he waited, his right fist clenched tight to the haft of the Grain Life Support System 10, the LS-10 his weapon of choice for the task at hand. John Rourke saw the first of the climbers, the crown of a hooded head surfacing over the edge, then a hand groping, then both hands bracing and the chest visible. Then all at once, the white snow-smocked figure had attained the top. The man paused for the briefest instant, then turned back toward the face of the mountain, helping the second climber over the top. Rourke's gloved right fist balled on the LS-10. He knew Paul would be watching for his move. He made it. Rourke's knife slid past the man's gear and into his right kidney. At the edge of his peripheral vision, he could see Paul Rubinstein with the Gerber MK2 in his right fist. Rourke's man sagged downward, knees buckling.
Whew. No problems?
No problems.
They had dragged the bodies back into the rocks where they could not be seen. Rourke and Paul both glanced back toward the edge. There were only seconds before more of them would be coming, but he had to know the capability of the rockets.
What?
The casing's covered in ice, but I think there are some words on it.
Yeah? What's it say?
I don't know. The words are in German.
German?
Yeah, German.
All thought of discerning more concerning the nature of the rocket itself vanished. Rourke sagged forward for an instant, then looked over the dead man toward the edge of the mountaintop. Another climber. Rourke picked up the gray knife, drew back deeper into the rocks, and waited, his mind racing. Duplicity on the part of Colonel Wolfgang Mann and his leader, Dieter Bern? Rourke dismissed the thought. There was a firm bond of personal friendship between him and Dr. Munchen, at the very least, even Hartmann, the military commander with whom he had so closely worked. Rourke told himself he would have sensed something if it were wrong. If these men were Germans, why M-16s? Eden Project equipment, doubtlessly. Why were they performing the evident bidding of Commander Christopher Dodd? The climber was rising over the edge, and over the wind's howl, as the man turned away from the edge, Rourke could just make out the man's shout.
Weil! Etwas ist hier falsch!
John Rourke was up, moving, driving his body forward toward the edge, his arm driving his knife forward still faster. Rourke saw Paul moving toward the edge. The Gerber shifted into his left fist, the Schmeisser swinging forward, tensioning on its sling. Rourke arced back to find the pistol grip of the M-16.
Horst! Horst!
The call came from near the edge, and Rourke dropped to his knees, the muzzle of the M-16 swinging up. Paul Rubinstein dropped down beside him.
They're German, Paul.
German? But...
we'll discuss it later.
Shut up. Get down!
The German MP-40 submachine gun had stabbed over the edge, firing blindly, but the distance was close enough that an errant round could hit. Rourke creeped over to a nearby edge and stabbed his M-16 over.
Oh, shit!
He pulled back to cover.
What the hell do we do now?
Get out!
The mountain vibrated under the impact as the rocket detonated above them. After an interminable period, Rourke pushed himself up, clumps of snow tumbling from the hood of his parka, his rifle half buried in it. Rourke's right hand found the Python and ripped it from leather. He rushed back to the edge and swung the muzzle online toward the edge of the drop as the first of the climbers became visible. Paul Rubinstein was moving now, the Schmeisser gone as he sat up, Rourke seeing him at the far edge of his peripheral vision. Paul's hands held his own M16 that had been slung on his back. The gunfire served little more than a suppressive function, keeping the attackers pinned to the rock, but it gave Rourke enough time to aim in on a second man.
I'm out! Gonna reload!
The three remaining climbers took advantage of the momentary break in fire. Until Paul got back to reload, Rourke was pinned.
What was that?
An explosion. Let's check.
Annie Rourke Rubinstein ran to a monitor console, Kuranami behind her. The lens of the camera at the summit was partially obscured with snow and ice, but she was barely able to see her father and her husband, collapsed as a shower of snow and rock debris rained down around them, the fireball of some tremendous explosion still dissipating skyward.
Elaine! When we are outside, close the doors! Keep the retreat closed unless you see us on camera and we're all right!
We're going outside.
We can't wait any longer.
Kuranami had no coat, but his right hand held an M16, his left a Beretta 92F, a knife almost as impossibly long as her father's LX-10 sheathed beside his left hip. Annie didn't know exactly what she would do as she exited through the doorway, the cold biting into her like steel, her hands almost instantly numbing on the pistol grips of her rifles. They had been waiting beside the entrance to the escape tunnel, which led to the top of the mountain when the explosion had come, and suddenly she had realized that waiting was no longer possible. Her glimpse of the video monitor had confirmed that. She was running now, her hair blown across her face and over her eyes like a heavy veil, running toward what before the awakening had been the garden in which she had grown the tobacco for her father's cigars. From the vantage point of the garden spot, she would be able to lay down a heavy volume of fire onto the mountain's face where the climbers had been. If they were the origin of the explosion, logic dictated they were, perhaps she could prevent a second one. Kuranami was just ahead of her.
The garden! Akira!
Did he know where the garden was? Yes, he would have seen it when he and Elaine had first visited the retreat when they were the first man and woman to return to Earth from the Eden Project shuttles. Inside herself, she had always thought it was so romantic that Akira and Elaine had fallen in love that they planned to marry, like Adam and Eve in a way, the first man and first woman. She fell, pulling up the hood of her parka as she rose, the hood filled with snow and spilling down the back of her neck, where her hair had blown over, down inside her sweater and under her blouse, chilling her still more. But Annie kept running. The assault rifle fire was still far away. Was it her father and her husband answering the fire of the climbers, or the climbers themselves? The shots had come from Akira Kuranami. He was firing toward the mountainside and the climbers there.
Oh.
Annie half stumbled to her knees near him, shouldering one of the M16s. She struggled to move her right thumb enough to work the selector, getting it to the auto position, then moving her right first finger against the metal of the trigger, flesh blistering to metal. She opened fire toward the rock face, Kuranami's rifle blazing beside her. The distance was too great for any real accuracy, and the angle was bad. She kept firing anyway, hoping for a lucky shot.
You hear that?
What? Annie?
Come on!
Rourke was up, slipping once, catching his balance, moving toward the edge now. Paul Rubinstein beside him. If Annie was firing at them from the ground, it would be a matter of seconds before the climbers would utilize one of their rockets against her. And this time, the rocket couldn't help but claim its target. Rourke fell prone by the edge of the rock face, ramming the M16 over the side. Paul did the same. Rourke peered over the edge for an instant. He saw three climbers remaining, the lead man suspended from a rope, cramponed into a rock face, perhaps 100 feet down. Another of the men was, awkwardly, readying one of the rocket tubes for firing. Rourke rolled onto his back, pulling his toque back up over his mouth, his chin numbing with the cold. The second man he had killed with his knife, the body, partially covered with blown-up snow and rock debris, lay only a few feet from him, eyes wide open in death and slowly covering with fallen snow. The haft of Rourke's knife and the double quillion guard and the blade stem almost cross-shaped over him.
Here.
What am I gonna do with two M16s?
Just hold on to it.
Rourke stabbed the python into its flap holster and closed it. Then he skidded on his knees toward the dead man, wrenching the knife free.
Paul, I'm going down to cut their rope. Get both of those M16s loaded and cover me. It's the only chance.
He didn't wait for an answer. The scraping of magazines out of and into magazine wells, the only answer he needed. Rourke was at the edge. There was a diagonally sloping shelf immediately below him, ridged as if some vastly harder rock had gouged across it, the ridges ice-filled and slicked. One solitary piton, no crampon could have been placed there, was set near the center.
Now!
Rourke's footing was gone for one terrifying instant, his body skidding laterally, his arms and legs spread-eagling, finding a purchase. He started creeping downward, his right arm lashed out, the piton slamming home. His body swung from it like a pendulum. Rourke flipped over onto his back, his mind racing, the gunfire still coming from the foot of the mountain. And in a moment he knew, there would be the whooshing sound of a rocket being fired. And if it were Annie down there, it had to be, she would be dead. Gunfire from above, Paul Rubinstein firing through the defile toward the climbers below. Rourke's left hand edged to his pistol belt, opening a buckle, ice and snow clotting it, his hand holding it at the buckle end. As he tugged at the belt, what he knew would happen, happened. The python started to slide free, and there was nothing he could do about it. Holster and gun skidded down along the rock face, disappearing over the edge. Gone forever? But his daughter's life was at stake. Rourke had the belt, nothing else on it this time out, his left fist tight over the buckle as he swung his arm outward and upward. Rourke swung his left arm again, hand contacting hand, the buckle going over the piton. His left first balling in the leather, then his right as he let go of the piton. Quickly, because time was gone, Rourke edged downward. He was at the base of the long sloping ledge and he found a purchase for his feet. He found a ledge. The rope that was the climber's lifeline, perhaps 50 feet below him now. He started down, hand over hand, his left hand slipping, his body skidding along the rock surface, his right booted foot ramming into a ledge, shale and ice dislodging, his descent slowing, his left hand finding a groove in the rock surface. He was stopped. Rourke looked down. Another 20 feet, gunfire coming toward him, chipping the rock face near his hands and feet and near his face. More gunfire from above. Paul. The gunfire from the base of the peak. Annie. The missile tube was fully extended by the man perhaps 50 yards below. There was no time left. Rourke turned his back to the mountain, almost tearing open his parka, biting off his right outer glove through the toque over his mouth, his inner gloved right hand finding the butt of the Detonic's minigun under his left armpit. The man's body seemed to go rigid. Then the tube fell from his right shoulder, going into the abyss below where the python had vanished, the body flopping outward and away from the rock face, the climbing rope shuddering. Rourke had an idea. He stabbed the Detonic's 45 outward toward the two crampons from which the climbing rope was suspended. His first shot rocked one of the crampons free of the rock, the rope snapping downward. The only thing holding up the remaining men was this single crampon. A miss. Only one shot remaining. There was no chance to grab at the second combat master. Rourke settled the muzzle, front and rear sights online. The 185-grain jacketed hollow point impacted high tensile strength steel and the rock into which it was set. The crampon rocketed away from the mountainside, and the rope snaked outward. Two men fell, their weaponry going with them. John Rourke closed his eyes, his head sagging back against the cold of the rock face. They had passed on from their uneasy campsite in the shadow of the mountains which sheltered the second city. Even the tiny Przewalski-like horses they rode seeming to sense the imminent danger, more unsettled than during the previous day's ride. Michael Rourke rode beside Han Lu Chen, whose family had died at the hands of Second City invaders. He was stonily silent. Otto Hammerschmidt riding drag with two of the six enlisted men of their force, one of these men Chinese, the other German. The mountains, which had been distant and gray, now seemed twice their original size, the gray deeper but with more pronounced shadings, and the granite upthrustings almost menacingly close. There was light snow here, and the wind was driving harder through the niches between the rock chimneys, making eerie whistling sounds. When a stronger gust blew, the unearthly howling seemed unnaturally heightened, and the animals would shudder and hesitate, edging nervously right or left. At these times, it was more necessary than usual to hammer at the animals' sides with the knees, to dig in the heels and urge them unwillingly ahead. Michael Rourke was reminded of the Valley of Death from the 23rd Psalm, but this was not a valley into which they rode now.
They will know we are here. They will be waiting for us, but perhaps we can kill some of them.
If you have such a lack of faith in this, why are you here? Orders only?
If Mao and his cutthroats and that evil bitch, his mistress, do not ally with us, they will ally with the Russians, and then there will be a nuclear war. It is better to die for one insane chance than to die huddled in a hole, I think.
I've seen nuclear war. You're right.
Michael's mount suddenly stopped, all but refusing to proceed. Han reined in a few feet ahead, the rest soon following. Michael Rourke licked his lips, looking upward into the rocks. There had been no howl of wind, no death-like whistling. His eyes squinted, and for a fleeting instant he thought he detected movement in the rocks above to his left.
Han, up there. Did you see it?
I saw nothing, Michael, but that means nothing.
There was something, I know it. Yeah!
Michael Rourke dug in his heels, and the animal beneath him vaulted ahead, reared, swinging left, Michael leaning hard forward over the saddle, hands knotting in the animal's mane. Prokopyev looked at Yaroslav and then spoke into his helmet-mounted radio headset.
This is Prokopyev. The riders are entering the kill zone. On my command, all elements open fire. Be ready.
Prokopyev settled the small of his rifle stock more comfortably into his left hand, waiting. Watching as the two men in civilian clothes and the seven others, almost evenly divided between two uniform styles, four of the uniforms recognizable as German, rode ahead.
Be ready, comrades.
The riders were coming. With the Chinese army advancing, he and Yaroslav and the men of his force had all but encountered them several miles distant. The horses of the men in the gorge below them were the only obstacle against rendezvousing with the extraction helicopters. Even if the gunfire were heard, as well it might be, the Chinese army was on horseback as well. Prokopyev had never ridden a horse, doubted that any of his men ever had, but the horses could be ridden, even a few of them. The rest of his force staying behind to hold off the enemy forces, while others went to meet the gunships that were to extract them and then came back with the gunships. There was no possibility of radio contact with the gunships because they would be out of range and under enforced radio silence. But Prokopyev smiled. Either he or old Yaroslav could persuade the pilots to fly back for the others and engage the Chinese forces if necessary, even if they couldn't be lawfully ordered to do so. That, or shoot the pilots and take the helicopters and fly them themselves. He could explain it away to Comrade Colonel Antonovich.
Remember, comrades, do not kill the horses. Open fire on my command.
Prokopyev blinked his eyes several times, began to regulate his breathing as he cheeked tighter to the rifle's straight-line buttstock. Michael Rourke felt it inside him, an uncomfortable feeling as if some other sense beyond the normal five were in operation. Was he becoming like Annie? But he felt something.
Wait, Han.
What's wrong?
Ever hear of the Lone Ranger?
Who?
Nothing. But somehow...
One of the Chinese soldiers went down from the saddle, his horse rearing, falling. Michael Rourke reached for his M16.
Weapons out!
Remind me to tell you the story sometime, Han!
Otto Hammerschmidt, who had been riding with his rifle in his hand, was returning fire, as were the three other Germans who had ridden the same way. Michael's own horse began to buck. He threw his right leg over the saddle horn and knotted his fists in the reins and mane.
Oh, shit!
The animal's neck twisted at an unnatural angle as it tumbled gracelessly to the unyielding ground. Michael Rourke threw himself behind the horse, bringing up his M16 to fire. One of the German soldiers went down, his horse spooked, dashing off to the horizon. The story, if he lived to tell Han about it, dealt with a massacre in a gap like this. But in Texas, thousands of miles and 6 centuries ago, long before men had ever thought about nuclear warfare and its barbaric, tenuous aftermath, Michael Rourke kept shooting. He had found his Python, the Metalife finish unscathed, but the cylinder impacted out of the frame, the rear sight broken off, and the barrel sprung, or wrenched out of true with the frame, as he had described it. Gun and holster had become separated during the tumble from the mountaintop.
Here you are, Dad. Seagram 7. Just the way you remember.
Oh, thanks, Annie.
Rourke and Paul were fresh from another 45 minutes in the Arctic-like temperatures, searching the bodies of the climbers and looking for the lost, now recovered and damaged revolver. Annie wondered if this whiskey was more of the real Seagram 7, or some of the whiskey Rourke had gotten the Germans to duplicate for him, which he had then put into the original centuries-old bottles. The Germans had duplicated his pet federal loads for the family's firearms, along with parts, lubricants, and all sorts of items.
Whew.
She sipped at the glass she had poured for herself. It tasted the same as Seagram 7 had always tasted, but it would have, of course, or her father would not have wasted his time bringing it to the retreat. It was a gross understatement, but John Thomas Rourke was a man of definite tastes. Sitting down on the sofa, which dominated the center of the great room, Annie burrowed her hands into the slit pockets at the sides of the ankle-length full-black skirt she had changed into. A shawl cocooned around her shoulders over the open-collared gray blouse, her black-stockinged feet in flat-soled Icelandic walking shoes. She felt almost human again, and physically more comfortable. She had showered under steaming hot water, thank God Akiro had activated the water heating system, and changed when it had proven useless that she might argue her way into accompanying her father back into the storm, as Akiro had.
So, Elaine, why were they trying to kill you and Akiro? I mean, what's behind it, Commander Dodd?
I think it's because of the computer files. They were wiped out, but Akiro had made copies before that, just in case. Duplicates, you know?
Uh-huh, and they want the duplicates. I mean, Dodd wants them.
I think that was it at first, but I think they gave up on that and decided their ends would be served just as well if Akira and I were dead and nobody at all knew where the duplicate files were hidden.
Where are they hidden?
Akira buried the copies he made about halfway between Eden Base and the German installation. You don't think it was the Germans, do you? I mean, they helped all of us so much and all.
Who knows?
Annie fished her left hand from her pocket now and took up her drink. It was strange, but she'd put ice cubes into it. She had been so cold, and here she was having a drink and using ice cubes. She wondered if humans were just simply insane. And an annoying feeling had been invading her thoughts. There had been no chance to mention it to Paul, and she didn't want to add the doubt it would sow to her father's already overwhelming burdens, Natalia, Sarah and the baby, and the problems of Akiro and Elaine with Commander Dodd. And now her father's revolver destroyed. But she sensed, no matter how she tried to fight it, that Michael was somehow in danger. Annie took a healthy swallow of her drink, and the feeling still didn't ebb away.
So you think Dodd is up to something with some unknown group of conspirators, correct?
Yes, Dr. Rourke.
Those men were probably German. No identification, of course, but one of them was named Vile, and another one of them called out for a man named Horst, evidently the third fellow we killed on the mountaintop. The rifles were M16s. I'd venture to say the serial numbers would match up to some of those missing from the Eden supplies. The handguns were German. The rocket launchers were German, but the launcher's not something I've seen in current German military inventory. Possibly something superseded and put out a surplus, more likely stored and subsequently stolen. I'd say just as a guess that they're Nazis.
Nazis?
Nazis again.
When Colonel Mann crushed the Nazi party in New Germany, it was only to be expected that the closet Nazis, or some of the ones who swore allegiance to Dieter Bern, weren't reconstructed, as they used to say. It would have been impractical, at the least, to attempt any sort of spiritual alliance with the communists. But someone at the German installation outside Eden Base could have sounded out Dodd, then laid out a deal. I never trusted Commander Dodd very far. If power was waved in front of him, as it evidently was, as well as the promise of unlimited access to German technology,
It's well within the realm of probability that he succumbed.
But what could he have offered them in return?
I'm just guessing, sweetheart. But I think the best thing he had to offer was a little legitimacy. He'd give the Nazis something they could work through, like in the old days when organized crime would buy into legitimate businesses or unions just so there was a front operation they could hide behind.
The corners of her father's mouth drew out and downturned, but his eyes smiled.
We may be sitting in at the dawn of a new era in perfidy.
Annie felt Paul's fingers tense against her neck for the briefest instant. She took her drink from the table and swallowed half of it, then leaned her head against Paul's right knee and closed her eyes for a moment. Michael Rourke had 6 full 30-round magazines and 2 partially empty ones. The contents of these latter, as he quietly assessed the situation, his M16 across his squatted legs, he combined into 1 magazine. At the distance, handguns were useless noisemakers, and a knife was mere wishful thinking. Fighting their way into the rocks on the far west end of the gap had been bought only through the wounding of another of the Chinese soldiers. But barricaded here as they were, it was impossible for the attackers on the west end of the gap to shoot down on them because of the overhang, and the only enemy fire that could reach them was from the rocks on the eastern side of the gap. The range between the so far anonymous ambushers and the position from behind which Michael Rourke, Han Lu Chen, Otto Hammerschmidt, and the others, including one of the wounded, returned fire was at least 200 yards. There seemed to be no immediate danger of being attacked from the rear by the enemy force above.
This seems like a standoff.
A standoff? What is that?
It's a term for what we're in. A situation in which neither party could gain the advantage, nor conveniently disengage.
That summarizes it well. Who are they, do you think? These Mao characters, Mongol mercenaries, or the Russians?
Russians, I think. The Mongols wouldn't have been denied the blood sport of riding down on us, even for a tactical advantage. And the Mongols would have shot the horses. Whoever is up in those rocks, Russians is my estimate. Once the horses arrive, notice how close the bullet was that took your own horse down, Michael. It impacted the horse's head. I think there is little doubt that they were aiming for you and missed.
The animals they had ridden and the pack animal grazed some distance away, where the snow covering was thin and there was some sparse ground cover, brown and dead, but evidently sufficiently tempting to keep them from bolting further away beyond the gap, despite the sporadically noisy interchanges of gunfire.
We cannot go forward, nor can we go back.
Michael Rourke had rescued his rifle, his saddlebags, his water bottle, and his sleeping bag from his horse. The bag was now warming one of the injured enlisted men. Inside the saddlebags was a medical kit, most of the contents already used in the preliminary treatment of the injured. Like his father, he had taken to carrying a musette bag almost constantly. Inside it, additional medical supplies, which his father had carefully taught both him and Annie how to use to stay alive. But advanced first aid training was not adequate to saving the lives of the wounded, and the condition of the German who had been shot off his horse in the first instance of battle was deteriorating rapidly.
Damn it! Hey! Who are you? I said...
I am Major Vasily Mikhailovich Prokopyev. I take it that you sue for surrender terms. To whom do I speak?
Bastard.
I am Michael Rourke!
He had debated whether or not, if these were Russians, to reveal his true identity. But to conceal it seemed pointless. The present situation was one step away from the grave.
We do not sue for terms that we might surrender to you, but instead offer you and your men a guarantee of fair treatment on condition of your surrender.
They are laughing.
That's to be expected.
Go ahead and laugh, Major Prokopyev. When my father, Dr. John Rourke, and the rest of the German-Chinese force arrives, let's hope you'll find that amusing as well.
Michael Rourke said nothing more, but neither was there any more gunfire. He felt it might be wise to explain the American term bluff to his compatriots, but he'd save that for later.
If the Russians weren't interested in shooting our horses, then the logical inference, if we can assume they aren't all dedicated animal rights activists, is that they require the horses, which may, in fact, be the purpose of the attack. Clearly, they're in what would have to be considered enemy territory with Mao's armies on the loose. What if our friends up in the rocks need our mounts in order to escape a pursuing force from the second city,
That would make sense. What if we shot the horses?
If there is a second city army pursuing these Russians, I would be loath to encounter them on foot. Assuming we do make it out of this, some of us, at least, horseback is our only chance. And if these Russians have somehow provoked Mao's wrath, we may not even have the opportunity to show the peace banner and be laughed at and disregarded. We will be slaughtered before they come sufficiently close to read it.
Michael followed Han's eyes to the rocky surface at the approximate center of the gap. The meticulously embroidered banner lay there, wrapped around its own pole, useless.
If they want our horses, they're trying to get to a rendezvous. Helicopter gunships, probably. This could be a reconnaissance patrol for a larger force. Shit.
The stalemate was still unchanged, despite having possibly deduced a rationale for it.
Prokopiev! How close is the army from the second city? Think they've heard the gunfire yet? Think they're going to come more quickly now? Think you have a chance alone against them? We'll shoot our horses first!
What are they waiting for?
They're considering. I think we've hit on something.
Will you meet me down there beside your banner?
Michael looked to the floor of the gap where the banner lay, then up to the rocks on the eastern side.
Once you step out into the open, what is to stop them from cutting you down?
If we don't do something, we'll all be dead. But I'll go instead.
Michael Rourke looked at both men, then back toward Prokopiev's position.
5 minutes! We'll both come armed, and that way if anyone tries any treachery, the other one will assuredly die.
Agreed, Rourke. 5 minutes.
Michael consulted the time as he leaned his M16 against the rocks behind which he crouched, then began removing the spare magazines for it from his gear.
I'll leave my rifle. There wouldn't be time to use it out there. If Prokopiev brings a rifle, so much the better. Slower to get into action. A Beretta, however.
I should go.
No. You know your way out of here. You can speak Chinese in case we do get to Mao's forces or they get to us. If I can convince him my father is coming after what my dad Natalia did to Karamazov, it might buy us out of here. And Prokopiev wouldn't have reacted so quickly if he didn't have some sort of force from the second city breathing down his collar. No, this is the only way.
Michael looked at his Rolex. It was nearly time.
If he tries anything, he dies.
If he tries anything, we might all die.
Michael stood up slowly, keeping his hands in plain view, with the leather jacket open so he could get at both Berettas.
Good luck.
Michael Rourke anticipated needing it as he stepped from behind the rocks and into the open. Prokopiev, Michael assumed it was the Soviet commander, was coming down from the rocks, a never-before-seen assault rifle slung crossbody beneath his right arm, a pistol holster at his belt, the uniform, the black battle dress utilities of the KGB Elite Corps, jump boots rather than jack boots. Prokopiev was tall, about Michael Rourke's own height, lean and well-muscled. He began walking out. Michael Rourke walked slowly toward the center of the gap, matching his pace to Prokopiev's, so they would arrive beside the fallen banner at approximately the same moment.
You have no rifle.
I don't need one, Major.
They faced each other, less than a yard apart.
So, who's running the elite corps these days?
I am.
Michael was momentarily taken aback, but countered in the next instant.
Personnel shortage with everyone promoting themselves since Karamazov died, is there?
You intend to provoke me, Rourke?
No. Not really. He was a cheap shot. Antonovich take over?
Yes. The comrade colonel shall avenge the murder of the hero marshal.
And you intend to help him?
Indeed, Rourke.
If the Chinese catch up with you before you touch base with your own people, well, that may be just a hope and nothing more.
He was consciously attempting to keep his English as idiomatic as possible, thereby hopefully confusing this man enough that any overstepped guesswork would go undetected.
What is it that you propose, Rourke?
Michael is fine. My friends call me that. I imagine some of my enemies do, too. I'll shoot you the straight shit, Vasily. May I call you that?
If you like.
Good. We were on our way to the second Chinese city in order to open negotiations with this Mao character. We want an alliance with him if we can get it. That should be obvious at any event. You want his access to the pre-war Chinese nuclear arsenal, and we don't want you to have it. Let's be honest about it. But with this gunfire, with some of our people wounded, with you guys around, I don't think now is the right time to go visiting. Especially since you probably have an attack force of your own en route to this area, and you were on an intelligence-gathering mission, right?
Go on.
I've got a substantial force of German and Chinese troops from the first city right behind us. That might not do us any good, though, if Mao's people are too close to you. You've got a rendezvous to keep, but you won't reach it in time to save your bacon without our horses. If you get our horses, we're stuck here as the reception committee for Mao's army. I was explaining to my heavily armed friends back there in the rocks that this is a standoff, a tactical situation that is stalemated. The The way it is now, nobody wins or loses, and we all wait here like sitting ducks for Mao's people to come along and kill us. Or worse.
What is it that you propose, Michael? I take it that you have prepared some solution to this situation, although I do not agree that it is this standout thing.
Stand off, Vasily. But you're just hanging tough. I admire that. You have us trapped, but your people can't get to the horses, while we can pick you off. If we keep shooting at one another long enough, Mao's people are going to come that much faster, and there's a substantial chance the horses will run out of grazing and wander off. And if your people haven't ridden before, they'll never control those horses. Nasty little critters, believe me. I've been a horseman since before the night of the war, and I have a hard time controlling them.
What is it that you propose?
Michael looked toward the horses, pausing for what he hoped was dramatic impact.
You have people waiting for you. We have people waiting for us. You probably have more men than we have horses, right?
Prokopyev paused for an instant, then his gray eyes flickered.
We do.
So you plan to kill us, take our horses and leave some men behind for a holding action, then get back and bail them out, right?
You mean rescue them? Yes, this was the plan. It was still work.
Vasily. Look, my plan is this. We have a temporary truce. I suggest expanding it and working together until the crisis is resolved. I'll pledge my word that if our people arrive first, you'll go unmolested. And I'll accept your word for the same treatment for us.
You are insane.
No, and you know I'm not. We have 7 horses remaining, 8 with the pack animal. I propose that 2 of our guys and 2 of your guys head for help to their respective forces. We hold the other 4 horses in reserve just in case. We take positions on the high ground on both sides of the gap here. That way, we can still start shooting at one another if we want. But we'll also have the gap bottlenecked and can hold back Mao's people, or try to at least, until help arrives, your people or ours. And if you have a medical technician who's got field surgery experience, we have one of our wounded who's dying. In exchange, our boys will teach your boys how to handle those horses. With men going in 2 different directions to 2 possible sources of help, we're doubling the chances that we'll make it out of this alive. What do you say?
You're serious.
Deadly serious. What about it?
Prokopyev looked to the still grazing horses, Michael following his eyes. As if on cue, the animals began edging further away.
You have my word. A sizable force is perhaps 2 hours behind us now. You should get on with this at once.
I'll get 2 riders. You get 2. Send over your surgeon and call your men out of the rocks over us. You and I can help wrangle the horses.
Wrangle?
You'll love it, Vasily. Trust me.
There were no friendly forces, German, Chinese, or otherwise, any closer than the perimeter of the first Chinese city. It was a stall for time and the chance to survive. Despite the fact that he had lied, Michael Rourke somehow felt his father would have been proud of him, if he lived long enough that his father would ever find out.
Han! I need you and 1 other man! Otto would be best!
There was always some means by which to cheat death. His father had taught him and his sister always some means to trick fate, if you had the mental agility to conceive it and the nerve to attempt it. Already, his mind was racing. He couldn't hear any comparable shouts from Major Vasily Mikhailovich Prokopyev, but he could be using the radio set Michael had observed attached to his helmet. If he could get Han and Otto out on horseback, ostensibly going for help, there might indeed be a way to sidestep what seemed inevitable. Michael felt the corners of his mouth raising in a smile. As Otto and Han came forward out of the rocks, Michael signaled them toward where the Przewalski-like horses were still grazing. Soon, Han and Otto were flanking him on the way towards the horses.
What did you say to that Russian major?
We formed a temporary alliance against a Maoist army that's about 2 hours away. 2 of his men will go to rendezvous with their extraction unit. At least I think so. You 2 are supposed to rendezvous with the German-Chinese army that my father's leading.
What army?
This is insane!
No shit. We know my father's in Georgia, and the nearest friendly forces are all the way back at the first city. He doesn't, evidently. If he's a man of his word, which I doubt, then we can rely on the agreement we made of mutual safe conduct whichever reinforcements arrive first. Assuming the contrary, it'll be up to you guys to bail me and the rest of your men out.
How?
They were nearing the horses, the 2 Russians coming down from the rocks to join their commander. The other Russians, who had been in position above the overhang on the western side of the gap, fully visible now as they crossed the long way down toward the gap at the far end of the bottleneck. It would be easier to ambush forces coming from that direction. There was little time. Michael reached the horses first.
Yeah. All right. You two ride out. Well enough away that you won't be detected, even with binoculars, from the eastern wall. Then you'll have to circle back the long way so you won't be spotted. I'll be up on the western wall with the rest of our guys. The Russians will be on the east wall. You'll have to come up behind them. We'll have to gamble on using the radios that they won't pick up our frequency. Then we go for getting them in a crossfire if it comes to that. I don't like this.
Michael Rourke's stomach churned at thoughts of such duplicity, but the Russians would do worse, he told himself. But would they?
I don't like it, but we don't have any choice. Just get back as fast as you can without being detected and we'll play it by ear. That's all we can do. And hope you beat that Maoist force here. Otherwise, we're all up the creek.
The creek?
It's a narrow, flowing body of water. In this case, it's brown and sticky and it smells like human excrement. And we'll be up to our eyeballs in it if this doesn't work.
Otto was the poorest of them with horses, and he passed over the reins from his own horse, more subdued now, to the German commando captain, Hahn doing the same with another of the animals. The Russians had joined them now.
Vasily, get your guys to help keep these animals under control while we get the others. Come on and give us a hand.
Of course I will. Oh, what was that?
Oh, that? That means she likes you.
Dr. Munchen was back at Iceland base, and John Rourke had powered up the radio transceiver. He now waited, listening to the static as Munchen was called to the receiver.
Munchen here. Over.
This is John Rourke, Doctor. I'm sorry to get you out of bed. Over.
It is always a pleasure to speak with you, Dr. Rourke. How may I assist? Over.
I need a frank answer to a very frank question, and I have no choice but to trust your response, Doctor. Over.
Go ahead. Over.
Since this transmission could be monitored, there should be no purpose in clearing the room, but if you wish, I'll wait. Over.
As you say, Herr Doctor, this transmission might well be monitored, if only by accident. Pray, ask. Over.
John Rourke looked at his daughter, his friend Paul Rubinstein, at Akira Kurinami and Elaine Halverson. They virtually ringed him as he sat before the radio transceiver, which had been given to him by the Germans in the first place.
This is a difficult question, Dr. Munchen. Is there an active Nazi underground movement of which you are aware which might be working for the violent overthrow of Dieter Bern's government? Over.
I cannot talk concerning this over an unrestricted frequency, Herr Doctor. Nor under the present circumstances. Over.
I understand, Dr. Munchen. I'll look forward to discussing this at greater length sometime in the future, should circumstances permit. Now go back to bed. Work out.
And you do the same, Herr Doctor. Munchen out.
That's as definite an answer as I could have hoped for. Annie, get on the radio to the German base outside Eden Base. Call in for a chopper if they can risk getting one up, or a J-7V to pick us up at the base of the mountain. All of us, if you're willing to take the gamble. Because Dodd knows the location of the retreat, and he's just going to send someone after you if you stay behind. I don't think any of the explosives they had with them could have burst through enough granite to penetrate the retreat. And while Annie's making that radio call, Paul, you and I are going to put more insulation behind those escape tunnel doors. Akira, if you'd give us a hand, we'd appreciate it. Next time they run a thermal scan, they won't find anything. I should have thought of that when I originally built this place.
What about Commander Dodd?
He won't dare do anything openly with me there, and we might be able to force him to back off just by going to Eden Base. We know his secret, so he'll want all of us dead as quickly as he can get it done. But not openly, not officially, because this Nazi thing could ruin him, and he knows it. Well?
Kurinami looked at Elaine Halverson again. She put her hand in his, Rourke judging the gesture as at once physical and symbolic. Akira Kurinami looked into John Rourke's eyes.
We will go.
Good man.
Nikolai Antonovich had excelled in tactics, but he had also learned that the obvious was too easily ignored. And now, as a commander, tactics were his to suggest, strategy his to determine. He had listened to the battle plans of his field commanders as they sat about the hermetically sealed, environmentally controlled tent, the Mongolian winds howling outside. But this was something he knew only because he had ventured out earlier and he had consulted the long-range weather forecast. The yellow cast of the overhead lights made the green chalkboards appear almost gray. He stood, merely to stretch himself, and all of his field commanders watched him as though he were about to do something important. He was beginning more and more to appreciate how being the supreme commander could convince a man that he was also a god. It had done so to the hero marshal, the hero egotist. Colonel Nikolai Antonovich had vowed to himself from the first that it would not do so to him. He had listened as battle plans were discussed, dissected, determined. And at last, when all his field commanders except Prokopyev, who was late for his helicopter rendezvous after the reconnaissance mission to the second Chinese city, had spoken, it was now Antonovich's turn. All eyes turned to him.
Comrades, we must consider the overall strategy now. Our allied enemies will never anticipate a move so daring in scope because they would view it as foolhardy. If it were to fail, indeed, it would be foolhardy, but we must risk all, or at least appear to do so. Our allied enemies know nothing of our normalization of relations with the underground city, and therefore grossly underestimate our strength and our abilities to resupply. Until tonight, none of you knew the overall strategy, but as each of you has revealed his battle plans, it will have become clear that we are about to engage in a three-pronged attack.
With that, Antonovich walked to the blackboard and reached over it to the mounted chart rollers. The central chart came down. It was a Van der Grinten projection of the world. On the map were three red stars. One over the location of the second Chinese city, one over the Hekla community of Lidveldid Island, the third over Eden Base in South Central American Georgia, which had once been the United States.
Simultaneously, we shall strike these three targets. We shall strike with such rapidity that there shall not be time or personnel for our allied enemies to react, let alone prevent our success. Here we shall strike against Eden Base and the German installation which guards it. Airborne elements will attack the German base here and neutralize radar and other sensing equipment, while helicopter gunships move in to destroy Eden Base here. The goal is to take the objective while keeping the destruction of the installation's runway facilities and technological capabilities below the level of 35%. Meanwhile, our troops shall attack the German installation which guards the Hekla community, utilizing the same general plan. That is to say that airborne forces will penetrate the base, destroy advanced warning systems, and open the door for a helicopter gunship force to attack the Hekla community itself. But, unlike the assault in American Georgia, the goal is total destruction of the German installation and total chaos in the Hekla community. With the base in American Georgia under our control, the base on Lidveldid Island will be insupportable and abandoned.
Antonovich watched the eyes of his officers. There was admiration there. The godhood thing. He shrugged it away. His hand moved to the third objective.
Here, the elite corps will parachute in and attack the city from the ground, striking boldly to the heart of the second city government, seizing control of communications, power, and other facilities, demanding surrender.
His hand drifted over the portion of Western Europe where at one time there had been the country of France.
On the return from Hekla community, our forces will strike at the small German installation which guards the lands where the wild tribes were relocated.
Some eyebrows were raised at his words, but he made no attempt to recant.
The goal in attacking this secondary objective is to further disrupt German lines of command and supply. There will be no attempt to attack the areas where the wild tribes are living, nor will the prefabricated factories which have begun servicing their needs for food and shelter be attacked. If the German technicians care to continue their work after the installation and the runways are destroyed, so be it. The area is of a humanitarian nature and therefore not a fit military target for the people of the Soviet. Unlike my predecessor, I have no thirst for genocide. This raid will be carried out quickly. Our troops will re-equip at the underground city, then proceed at best speed to reinforce our personnel at the second Chinese city and hold this position against the inevitable attack from the first Chinese city.
His eyes traveled over the room again.
The German units in Asia will be cut off and forced to surrender or die. the only serious German force will be baseless outside its homeland. As conditions permit, once our new territories have been secured, the new German homeland in what was Argentina can be assaulted and destroyed. Should its masters fail to realize the inevitability of their fate and surrender. And the Rorks, of course, will be without help. They will inevitably be captured and made to stand trial for their offenses or killed. And in the final analysis, the death of the hero Marshal shall be forever avenged.
And there would be peace, and the Earth could once again flourish, and with control of the nuclear weapons, the leadership of the second Chinese city could lead him to, that peace would be enforceable. He had read of the Pax Romana, the world peace achieved through military conquest. Nothing but complete hegemony. It was, in this case, the only way for the planet to step out of the dark ages of warfare into which, as the Americans had called it, the night of the war had thrust mankind. Whether this was the goal of the leadership of the underground city or not mattered little to him. If their minds were like, then let them run this new world he would give them. If their goals were other than his, they would be powerless to stop him. If he trusted anyone that thoroughly, he would have confided that the death of the hero Marshal might one day be looked upon as one of the singularly greatest moments in human history, for Karamazov would have destroyed the Earth. To rule among the ashes, to be master of the dead and dying, to know that in the end all would have been for nothing, seemed senseless, seemed mad to him.
And so, comrades, prepare yourselves. We strike in fewer than 24 hours, and we shall forever alter the course of the future. Questions?
There were none. The Chinese heavy cavalry were upon them before they realized, and before a radio transmission came in from Han Lu Chen and Otto Hammerschmidt. From his side of the gap, Michael had been unable to see, and the wind had risen, so as dark gray, almost black clouds had driven in from the west, he had been unable to hear. Fortunately, he had been provided a radio headset from his new ally, Major Vasily Mikhailovich Prokopyev.
They come!
I read. They're coming.
The Russian medical corpsman was still on his side of the gap, attending the injured. Most seriously wounded among them, one of the Chinese enlisted men. The few survivors clustered around Michael Rourke as he waited for Prokopyev to open fire. The Maoist cavalry was broken up into two distinct units. Men dressed in the furs and Astrakhan hats and informal body armor of the Mongol mercenaries, looking for all the world like something out of a Hollywood epic from centuries ago, and, the larger element of the mounted force, men in faded pale red battle dress utilities, gray military-looking parkas and baseball caps. Even the mounts of what Michael Rourke assumed to be regular army as opposed to mercenary were less spectacular. All a dull brown or gray, not the gleaming blacks and speckled Appaloosa-like mounts of the Mongols. Some of the Mongol horses, as opposed to the mounts of the regulars, were not the Przewalski-like animals so common here, but instead larger-bodied, broad-faced animals with powerful, sinewy necks and several hands taller as well, looking clearly to have Arabian lineage. Despite the natural independence of the breed, Michael Rourke felt these animals would be worth the challenge of a hard ride. He wondered if he would have the chance. The buttstock of the M16 was checked tight to his face, his right eye blinking periodically to keep from losing sight picture. He had taken aim on the evident commander of the force, a wizened-looking man of perhaps 70, but tall, once a formidable figure, as Michael judged it. From the braid which adorned his baseball cap, Michael judged him at least a field-grade officer, if not higher. But it was the philosophy of the old Cowboys and Indians movies he had watched as a boy at the retreat. Shoot the chief, and while the enemy was disorganized, make your play. He was ready to shoot the chief.
That old man is a general, I think.
I've got him, Vasily.
No, we'll need this man if there is to be any hope of forcing them back. Trust this.
You and I apparently grew up on different movies. John Wayne would have shot the guy.
John Wayne?
A famous actor, and in his way an ambassador of American moral values and philosophy.
I see. But do not shoot the old officer.
Fine. Shut up, will you, so I can shoot something?
Michael Rourke took a last glance at the old man, then shifted his rifle to another target, a younger officer. Prokopyev was the professional military man, Michael Rourke told himself. They were getting steadily closer. Michael settled his sights easily over the younger officer's chest.
On the count of three. One,
Michael Rourke suddenly asked himself why he was listening to this man at all. After all, Prokopyev had engineered the miserably failed ambush which had trapped him and the others here, but achieved no military purpose. What was to imply that Prokopyev could do better now?
True.
If it could be avoided, if they survived this, he would be just as content to leave Prokopyev to fight another day, and he would do all that was possible to ensure that. The duplicity he intended rankled him, but there was no other way for it. Where was Han? Where was Otto?
Three, now!
Michael's target rocked back and tumbled from the back of his rat-like horse, others falling around him simultaneously.
So much for diplomacy.
The struggle down the mountainside had been difficult, but most difficult on the women. Annie, of course, was in excellent physical condition, but Elaine Halverson's stamina could best be described as better than average, Paul thought, realizing that at times his thinking was becoming as clinical as that of a Rourke. He charted it off to propinquity and good fortune. But, as the pilot of the J-7V had recounted, and landing in the German installation outside Eden Base had confirmed, good fortune was something they all shared. Fresh from New Germany and Argentina, come to personally investigate the situation involving Kuranami and Halverson, was Colonel Wolfgang Mann, Supreme Military Commander of New Germany, a man whom Paul Rubinstein had once trusted and deeply respected.
Here are your quarters, Herr Kuranami. Would you and Fräulein Halverson prefer to share quarters?
Yes, if it's not too much trouble.
Of course not. Here you are. Wash up and get a good night's rest. Tomorrow morning, you all have a breakfast meeting with Colonel Mann.
Annie was dressed in a long skirt and lace-trimmed blouse of Icelandic fashion. Paul had asked, when they had packed their gear for the expedition to the retreat, why she had elected to waste precious ounces on things so seemingly patently unnecessary as a skirt and petticoat and a fancy blouse, and she had told him simply that she had her reasons. And he was convinced now, as he tasted the ground beef patties served so obviously instead of pork-based sausage, a German favorite, he had learned, in deference to his religion, that Annie could read his mind. Because his thoughts were consumed with her, he saw her watching him, smiling, almost blushing as he had recollected what they had done with each other's bodies early in the morning hours before they had slept. He forced his attention to his food and the conversation around him, and just in time, because Colonel Mann began to address him.
So, Herr Rubinstein, it is satisfactory? The food?
Yeah, and thank you for your consideration, Colonel.
It is nothing, Herr Rubinstein, but you are gracious to notice it. And I assure you, all is to the best of our abilities here. How do you say it?
Kosher?
Indeed.
Paul Rubinstein doubted the beef was exactly kosher, but it would serve.
And Frau Rubinstein, you are lovelier than ever. Marriage indeed must agree with you.
Thank you, Colonel Mann. And how is your lovely wife?
She is in excellent health, and I am certain will be furious that an opportunity to meet with so many members of the Rourke family at once has been missed. But...
He raised his hands, palms upward, in a gesture of resignation. Mann looked at Elaine Halverson, who sat across the table from him.
Dr. Halverson, although I know little beyond official reports of the nature of the difficulties which seem to beset you and Lieutenant Kuranami, I assure you that I will do all that is within my power to see that they are alleviated.
Now, this is sensitive, Colonel. Do you wish the attendants to leave? I'm sure we can pour our own coffee, and the ladies might be prevailed upon to help us if we get in trouble passing the eggs or the toast.
Paul Rubinstein watched as John's and Colonel Mann's eyes met.
Yes, a fine suggestion, Herr Doctor.
With but a nod, the enlisted personnel left.
More orange juice, Herr Doctor? Frozen from concentrate. The oranges grown in our own groves, as you know.
Yes.
Here, let me.
Annie was already up before Paul could reach for her chair, taking the orange juice pitcher.
Elaine, help me with the coffee?
Sure.
The coffee was freshly ground, and Paul Rubinstein had decided that he would drink it until he felt he could float.
This sensitive matter, Herr Doctor.
Colonel, I have reason to believe that there is a conspiracy of which you are already aware among supporters of the deposed Nazi leadership to forcibly overthrow your current government under Dieter Bern. I have evidence to support that some such persons as were involved in this conspiracy were acting in complicity with Commander Christopher Dodd, the de facto leader of Eden Base. Their overall purpose is unclear, but I assume it has to do with utilizing Eden as a legitimate front for their revolutionary activities. 8 men, whom Paul and I dispatched with some assistance, were in the process of attacking the retreat, my mountain home, in order to presumably kill Lieutenant Kuranami and his fiancée, Dr. Halverson, who were my guests. They were, by all appearances, German, and they utilized a mixture of German and U.S. small arms, along with a German-manufactured disposable rocket launcher, which, though delivering an extremely powerful explosive device, I would assume is not currently inventoried.
The R-19 MK-2?
Why? Are you missing some?
As a matter of fact, I am.
Well, consider 16 of the missing articles accounted for, then.
That leaves approximately 480 remaining.
Indeed.
Herr Rubinstein, it is a serious matter. Did you get any names?
The men involved, as I indicated, are no longer available for questioning. But Paul and I heard one of the men call another of them by the name Weil, and another one called Horst.
The one was Hans Weil. The other I would need to consult intelligence files for. Hans Weil was once a German officer. He was also a Nazi. He was never found after the victory against the leader and Dieter Berns taking charge of the government. At least, it appears, he is accounted for. He was SS.
How many more are there like him?
Regrettably, Frau Rubinstein, several hundred that we know of. There may be hundreds of others who openly profess distaste for the old regime, yet would support it were it to return. National Socialism dies hard. There are some who think it never dies. And these men were attempting to penetrate your mountain retreat in order to kill Dr. Halverson and Lieutenant Kuranami?
Yes, Colonel. At the order of Commander Dodd, most likely. With his complicity, almost certainly. I'm asking that Akiro and Elaine be given sanctuary here, regardless of Dodd's wishes or demands. Arrest them if you'd like, on some charge or another, so you can hold them in custody if diplomacy will be best served. But don't return them to Dodd. Otherwise, they'll be killed through some contrivance or another. I think we both know that.
Why do you think I came, Herr Doctor? Because I enjoy this rather disappointing climate?
Ah. I have your assurances, then.
Yes. And I would like to have your help, Herr Doctor. I must unearth the leaders of this conspiracy against the Vaterland. And I imagine you would be equally interested in bringing Commander Dodd to book.
Before the discoveries I learned of at Midwake, as I wrote you by dispatch, and as Dr. Munchen's accounts have no doubt reinforced, I was firmly convinced that the best method for destroying a cancer was, if all else proved inadequate, excision. Well, I have since learned of subtler methods, but it is, after all, the end result which is important.
Paul Rubinstein at times felt like John H. Watson, despite the fact that his weight was all wrong for the part.
Michael, my son, has gone off to the second Chinese city. Before attempting to solve this Dodd matter, if you'll indulge me, I'd like to get back to China. We still have a substantial lack of meaningful intelligence concerning Karamazov's forces and who's running the show in his place. And I'd like to be nearby just in case Michael's embassy...
A peace mission, yes. To the second Chinese city. I recall it was to be undertaken. There is so much happening.
Agreed. But Hartman is monitoring the movements of the Soviet army and the events at the underground city. He's spread a bit thin. If something should go wrong with Michael's mission, I want to be close enough to act.
My best wishes, then, of course. I would relieve Hartman's command, were it possible. But with maintaining bases here and in Iceland, and in what was France, and Hartman's existing force to monitor the Soviets, I am severely undermanned at New Germany. Were the Russians to strike there in force, we would be hard-pressed to repel them.
I understand, and the last thing you need is an enemy within. I'll get back to Eden Base as soon as practical. I'd ask Paul to volunteer, or Annie for that matter, but if I'm needed, we'll all be needed together.
Agreed. Yes.
What will happen when Dodd learns we're here?
We'll be fine.
Indeed you will. But we may find out shortly. I instructed that he be informed the moment you arrived. Since I have little use for Commander Dodd, I thought it only fitting that he be awakened from a peaceful sleep by news of your arrival. So far he has done nothing. But the morning is still young. And I assure you, you and your lieutenant shall be afforded the full and considerable protection of New Germany, Fräulein Doctor. That is my pledge.
John Rourke raised his coffee cup.
Let's drink to that, then.